Welcome to Dare to Struggle, Dare to Win, a monthly podcast by the U.S. Human Rights Network, addressing human rights issues in the United States. I'm your host, Sacagawea Hall. The month of May has been important for the rights of Indigenous peoples. James Anaya, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, concluded his first official visit to the United States on May 4th. Also this May, the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues held its 11th session. In this month's podcast, we speak with Andrea Carmen of the International Indian Treaty Council and Tupac Enrique Encosta of Tantantera. First, we have a report from the protest of Bank of America in Charlotte, North Carolina. On May 9th, hundreds of activists from across the country gathered in Charlotte, North Carolina, to protest at the Bank of America headquarters. Direct action took place both outside and inside the annual shareholders meeting. The demonstration was organized by the Unity Alliance, a collaboration of alliances including Grassroots Global Justice, Jobs with Justice, the National Day Laborer Organizing Network, the National Domestic Workers Alliance, the Pushback Network, and the Right to the City Alliance. Sarita Gupta, Director of Jobs with Justice, says Bank of America is an example of the worst of the 1%.
Well, we mobilized over 100 people to come down along with many other groups because Bank of America discriminates against low-income communities and communities of color through their predatory lending practices, yet somehow they get rewarded by massive tax breaks. And they frankly don't pay their taxes. And meanwhile, we've bailed them out, right? So there's something wrong here. And as the 99%, as part of the 99%, we want to say enough is enough. Bank of America has spent nearly $16 million in lobbying against consumer protection laws and workers' rights to organize. So we're out here to say the 1% and corporations and banks like Bank of America should not be getting in the way of our democracy. Their practices need to change.
Activists also cited Bank of America's foreclosure rate as the highest among banks. The day before the demonstration, Bank of America announced it would reduce the principal for 200,000 homeowners. But activists say that is a drop in the bucket compared to the 11 million homeowners underwater, meaning they owe more on their homes than their homes are worth. Another key issue raised was Bank of America's funding of coal mining and mountaintop removal. Adam Hull from the Keeper of the Mountain Foundation describes the issue and his organization's demands.
First of all, they do not have to destroy mountaintops. You can go underground and mine. They say it's more economical to get the coal from blasting off these tops of the mountains. What they don't factor in is that when you blast these mountains off, you're exposing heavy metals to oxygen. The heavy metals oxidize and they leach into the groundwater supplies. This groundwater goes straight into people's drinking water, and it poisons them. It gives them cancer, neurological diseases, anything you can imagine that's in your body. It goes wrong from drinking your water. It goes wrong when you drink that water from a mountaintop removal site. In 2008, they promised that they would stop financing MTR. Yet in 2010, that they were responsible for providing 40% of the funding for companies that do MTR. We're here to demand that they are making good on their promise.
Dana Kumine with the Rainforest Action Network is also concerned with the health risks coal mining poses and the destruction of the environment. She says mountaintop removal has destroyed over 500 mountains across the Appalachia.
I worked with a community for a long time that had dramatic increases in very rare brain cancers due to their common well water, which was poisoned by coal. So we're very concerned about coal, and the process of mountaintop removal is very expensive, and it uses very expensive equipment that's underwritten by Bank of America, who have actually given over $3 billion to the coal industry. And so what we're asking is for them to put that billions of dollars into renewable energy that will make our community stronger and stop making us sick.
Activists protesting Bank of America were not the only people upset that day. Richard R.J. Eskow, a journalist and former Wall Street executive, was in Charlotte to attend the shareholders meeting. He held the proxy for 82,000 shares, but could not participate in the meeting because of limited space.
You know, I wrote something yesterday saying a lot of angry people are going to be coming to Charlotte tomorrow to voice their grievances, and I'm talking about the shareholders, not just the people here in the street. The police are taking preemptive actions in the city of Charlotte, they say, to prevent lawbreaking, but the longest rap sheet in North Carolina belongs to the Bank of America, documented criminal behavior.
Inside the meeting, the atmosphere was tense as angry shareholders questioned CEO Brian Moynihan amidst off-duty police officers guarding the meeting. despite the protesters outside and shareholders inside expressing their disapproval of Bank of America's practices, the meeting resulted in business as usual. Investors passed all three of the bank's management proposals, including Moynihan's $7 million package for 2011, while voting down all six stockholder proposals, one of which called for an independent review of the bank's internal controls related to residential mortgage modifications, foreclosures, and securitizations.
The UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, James Anaya, finished his official visit to the United States on May 4th. As a UN Special Expert, James Anaya traveled across the country, gathering information from Indigenous peoples and communities, along with the government, to assess how the standards of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples are reflected in U.S. law, policy, and programs. The UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples establishes a universal framework of minimum standards for survival, dignity, and rights of Indigenous peoples around the world. It was adopted in 2007, and the U.S. endorsed the declaration in 2010. James Anaya will write a report on his findings, which will provide his assessment and recommendations. Andrea Carmen joins us to give an update on the Special Rapporteur's visit. Andrea Carmen, a member of the Yaqui Indian Nation, is the Executive Director of the International Indian Treaty Council. She has many years' experience working with Indigenous communities from North, Central, South America, and the Pacific. Andrea, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
In a press release issued at the end of his visit, James Anaya said, quote, "In all my consultations with Indigenous peoples in the places I visited, it was impressed upon me that the sense of loss, alienation, and indignity is pervasive throughout Indian country." He goes on to say that there was almost a universal call for U.S. government to respect tribal sovereignty, that Indigenous peoples' ability to control their own affairs be strengthened, and that the many existing barriers to the effective exercise of self-determination be removed. Andrea, what are some of the barriers to sovereignty and self-determination that he refers to?
Well, one is that the United States laws, including and in particular those addressing legal constraints on the recognition of Indigenous nations that was established as a nation-to-nation relationship under treaties when the period of first contact in the next couple hundred years after that between Indigenous nations and the United States government. Those laws today are still being implemented based on the construct of what's called the Doctrine of Discovery, which changed that nation-to-nation relationship to one of basically a conqueror and a conquered in their point of view. Indigenous peoples maintain we're not conquered, not defeated. In many cases, we were able to achieve military victories against the settler governments, and the only way that they could subdue the Indian nations was by killing off their food sources and making it so the choice was between starvation or coming on to the reservation and becoming what they call now in federal Indian law domestic sovereigns, which is a contradiction in terms. So, yeah, a lot of the laws and policies that have been put in place since that time, which included as well something very significant that was raised across the country in presentations to Special Rapporteur Anaya, was the genocidal effects that linger to this day in Indian communities of the forced removal of children to boarding schools, which was across the country and across the board, and the official policy was stated, kill the Indian, save the child. You know, all of those issues together have made it so the original, you know, sovereign nations of Indigenous peoples that entered into nation-to-nation treaties, you know, that status has been undermined, and the ability to exercise what would be called sovereignty or self-determination on a much reduced land base with many, many restrictive laws and policies in place are the challenges that James and I heard about as he went across the country. I know here, you know, our oldest presenter was almost 90 years old, and the youngest one was 5 years old. and all, the whole range of community members talked about, you know, their opinions on why the coal mining would be, you know, incredibly detrimental. Their right of free, prior, informed consent is being denied. They do not have the right because of the different kinds of land laws here and the restrictions on their original tribal sovereignty and self-determination. They don't have the right to say no to something that is potentially devastating on every level to them. And I don't mean to say they don't have the right. That right is inherent and it's recognized in the UN Declaration. They do not have the ability to exercise that right because the different levels of government that they're dealing with, from the United States all the way on down, the subsidiary governments down to the local level, do not respect that right.
I wanted to ask you about some of your submissions. Two of the submissions that you gave to the Special Rapporteur addresses environmental toxic policies, the impact on health that toxins have on indigenous communities, particularly women, children, and the unborn. In them, you say the U.S. policies constitute environmental violence and environmental racism.
A lot of women testified about the impacts of, you know, horribly toxic mining processes, coal mining, gold mining producing arsenic and mercury, military toxics dumped on places like St. Lawrence Island and never cleaned up, so the PCB levels are 90 times, you know, in the blood serum of the community members of what's supposed to be permissible, and then the levels in their traditional foods, you know, walrus and whale are 400 times what's supposed to be acceptable to even eat, you know, and the EPA standards. So indigenous peoples are facing, you know, cultural crisis too, because these foods and the practice of our subsistence and using those foods is not just nutritional, it's cultural and ceremonial. And you have a choice between, you know, exposing your children to, you know, to insane levels of toxicity, or abandoning your traditional practices. And, you know, that's a false choice. And the very fact that indigenous peoples are being confronted with that choice is a violation of our human rights as defined in many, you know, international instruments to which the U.S. is a party. It's environmental violence because it's intentional. Somebody is making choices based on what's called acceptable risk. You know, what are the numbers of cancers or birth defects that are deemed acceptable by somebody in some boardroom? And it's our communities that are seen as the ones that are acceptable to, you know, target with. The second reason is the effects are well known. The impact is known, and somebody is making an economic or sometimes a military choice to continue using these substances and target certain communities, our communities, with these impacts. So, you know, here in Alaska, Native children have four times the amount of birth defects than non-Native children. In the end of the day, these chemicals affect all of us. There's one global ecosystem, and we're all breathing the same air and drinking the same water at the end of the day. And, you know, not only humans, but the whole natural world is in serious threat because of these kinds of things, including from, you know, global warming and climate change tied into coal burning and many other processes that also produce toxics on the ground, oil drilling and tar sands extraction, and all such things affect the communities that they're happening in, and they affect communities around the world.
So what is the obligation, what is the United States' obligation according to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples to address these issues?
Well, because the declaration is really an interesting, you know, interpretation that some of the states feel is that that means it's not as binding as a convention, that it's aspirational. But what that means, aspirational, you know, to us that means that they've made a sacred obligation to bring their laws and policies up to that level. And there is moral pressure, there's political pressure, but even in the case of legally binding conventions, as I mentioned, there's no mechanism or structure internally in the United States that says, oh, we're not living up to this obligation, let's fix this law, you know, or this policy is not in accordance with our human rights obligations, so we need to fix this. And there must be immediate steps by the U.S. government to bring its laws and policies into alignment. We have no doubt that James Anaya's recommendations are going to be excellent, and even the things he's already talked about in terms of, you know, return of land, in terms of mechanism for redress, including treaty violations, in terms of changing laws and policies so they're based on, you know, on justice and fairness and equal recognition, you know, of standing of peoples and nations that now live on this land called the United States. But then we are really going to, we know the challenge is going to be with implementation, and this is not the first time this is going to come up. That, I think, is the biggest central challenge and objective of the human rights community across the board, is looking at how we can put those mechanisms in place so that there is accountability and there is follow-up.
Thank you. As we wrap up, can you let people know how to get in touch with the International Indian Treaty Council for more information?
Sure. We have a web page, www.treatycouncil.org. It's in the process of being upgraded. Within a couple of months, we're going to have a beautiful new web page, finally, after all these years. My email is andrea@treatycouncil.org. I'm the executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council, and our main office in San Francisco, the phone number is 415-641-4482.
Okay, great, Andrea. Thank you. It's always a pleasure to have you.
Okay, thank you.
Also this month, the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues held its 11th session. The Permanent Forum is an advisory body to the UN's Economic and Social Council, or ECOSOC. The Permanent Forum submits recommendations on issues related to Indigenous peoples. This year, the theme was the Doctrine of Discovery. Tupac Enrique Acosta joins us to discuss the Doctrine of Discovery and share his organization's participation in the forum. Tupac is one of the founding members of the community-based organization of Indigenous peoples, Tona Tierra, in Phoenix, Arizona. He is a longtime researcher and activist in the field of Indigenous international law. Tupac has traveled to areas of armed conflict in Chiapas, Mexico, Guatemala, Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Canada, and across the U.S. to monitor and report on the violations of civil, human, and territorial rights of Indigenous peoples. Thanks, Tupac, for joining us.
Thank you.
So I wanted to start off with asking you to explain what the Doctrine of Discovery is.
Well, it's a paradigm. The Doctrine of Discovery is that set of cognitive conceptions that put in place the justification, in theological terms, the colonization of Indigenous people's territories across the planet, but in particular, as it was applied here in this hemisphere of what is now known as the Americas, after the Doctrine of Discovery imported that name from Amerigo Vespucci, Abya Ayala's a more current, more correct ancestral term in terms of Indigenous peoples for this hemisphere, Abya Ayala. The Doctrine of Discovery was used beginning in 1492 to paint the justification of theology, the imposition by domination of the regimes of colonization at the hands of the European Americans under conceptions of civilization superiority, race superiority, and civilization superiority for the Christian Western world. And so that doctrine to this day is still used in court decisions, and it's part of the master's narrative, the underlying master's narrative that leads to the fomentation of policies and politics of subjugation and colonization of Indigenous peoples, such as we have here in Arizona, most recently and most blatantly exemplified by the AZ SB 1070. But with the Doctrine of Discovery in place, even Amy Goodman can get away with presenting ACSB 1070 as immigration law when it has more to do with another technique and tactic of colonization of the Indigenous peoples in the territory now known as Arizona as a result of Manifest Destiny, which is an extension of the Doctrine of Discovery. And this is all well known and corroborated in the highest levels of academic presentation, which we took this evidence into the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues this last session just a couple of weeks ago. And there was absolutely no rational response on the part of the government states, not just the U.S., but all of the government states in the hemisphere. There's no way to justify the doctrine of discovery.
Can you tell us a little bit about the presentation that you, your organization did at the Permanent Forum?
Well, we participated in a poll court press, I would say, because from pole to pole, from Alaska, from the northern reaches of this hemisphere to the very tip of the southern point of the Mapuche countries, we presented a united front in denunciation. Our organization was just one of the many that, in comprehension, continentally, from indigenous peoples' perspective, as nations and peoples that precede every single one of these government states that are now recognized in the UN system as being the authority of jurisdiction on our hemisphere, all of us presented with the integrity of reality that these doctrines of racial supremacy and civilizational prejudice that emerged from the era of colonization have to be put to rest, and we have to move on collectively with collective actions to address the human rights violations that have been perpetuated in the name of these concepts of civilization. One of the things that did come to light, besides the denunciation of the crimes committed against the indigenous nations' territories and peoples, our human rights and our territorial rights, was also the simple fact that these violations are also violations of the Europeans, Americans themselves, of their right to be human and to have a human relationship with the rest of us on the planet and not have to engage with us from within the constraints of the doctrines of colonization, such as the doctrine of discovery is a prime example. So it's a healing process that we were engaged with at the UN to bring humanity back to our real relationships as human beings with each other without the constraints and deformations of doctrine and colonization.
So getting back to briefly, you mentioned the HBSB 1070 as a manifestation
right.
of the doctrine of discovery. What are some of the other ways that it's manifested today?
Well, just speaking from the local frame, we know, and I'm sure the national audience is also aware of, so-called ethnic studies fight. You know, the bills, the legislation coming out of Arizona having to do with the Mexican-American program at the high school level in Tucson. And that's another example of a misframing, ethnic studies. The fact is that it's not an ethnic studies bill, the 2281. It's a bill that highlights the ethnic studies of European Americans as the only criteria for measurement of intellectual achievement. And what we're simply saying is that what's more appropriate would be to pursue studies of indigenous peoples along the lines of the peoples who are indigenous nations of the territory, which would, by historical and cultural reality, have to include the Mexican peoples as part of the original confederations of indigenous nations of Anahuac, preceding Spanish and Hispanic and Latino presence and arrival. So these are another examples of how the distortions of doctrine have clouded intellectual evaluation to be impartial, and instead we're being presented claims of ethnicity that are derivatives of the European American conceptions of what it is to be an ethnicity, what it is to be a tribe, what it is to be Indian, what it is to be the other. And these are all conceptions of personality and social identity that are derivatives of the Western conceptions of civilization itself, to where the human being is not an integral and natural part of the natural world, but is a dominator and an empire builder who creates civilization by the destruction of the natural world. And this is the reality, these are the realities that we're bringing to the forefront, and these are the intellectual instruments of colonization that we are also challenging. And so this is the fight of indigenous peoples planetarily, from all continents, from Asia, Africa, Europe, Oceania, and this continent of Oceania. We're joined together at the UN at this last session to show that we're still in this fight, we're in the ring, but we're not going to settle for anything less than self-determination and also the protection of the rights of Mother Earth.
Okay. What you mentioned some of the work in Arizona around the HBSB 1070 and also your fight around the ethnic studies bill. What else is there that you guys are working on that you might want to share?
Well, we did accomplish the final report and the recommendations from the Permanent Forum. This last session does call for the states to provide public instruction in the public schools and the public systems of education on the doctrine of discovery, which is one of the demands here in Arizona to address the issue of the prejudice that is instituted in the ethnic studies legislation that 2281 exemplifies. Our response was to demand that the true history of the relationship of the European Americans with all the rest of the Americas and the Americans and the indigenous peoples of Ayala, that be brought to light as part of the public instruction, the mandates of the public instruction. So that demand was presented to the UN Permanent Forum, and they supported that demand, have now called for not just Arizona, but all the 50 states, and not just the 50 states of the U.S., but all of the states in the continent, and not just all the states in the continent, but all of the states in all of the world, to address in public instruction the impact of doctrine of discovery, how it relates to the human rights of humanity at the planetary level. So we plan to bring that home here to Arizona and take our demands to the Department of Education to its next step to have that instruction actually take place. But we're not waiting for them. We're actually already doing that. We have an online public instruction, a curriculum available to make that available, which includes the presentation that we made in the Arizona State Capitol at the House of Representatives on March 23rd, where we took 3 hours on the floor of the House of Representatives and brought forward our perspectives and testimony on the impact of the doctrine of discovery here in Arizona.
Maybe you can also share with us how your organization participated in the special rapporteur's visit.
Sure. Well, when Mr. James and I, when Professor James and I conducted his consultations, we were invited and we participated, brought our interventions forward to Mr. Nair for his consideration and integration into the report that he's compiling on the situation of human rights for indigenous peoples within the bounds of the U.S., the historic visit that he conducted. Our particular intervention had to do with addressing the issues of indigenous peoples within the U.S. context, but also as they interrelate with the context of NAFTA. At the initiation of colonization by the European Americans, they brought in their colonies, they brought in their viceroyalties, they brought in their haciendas. But we don't have colonies, we don't have viceroyalties, we don't have haciendas. Now we have, we went to plantations, and now we have corporations, and now we have NAFTA. But the same dynamic of colonization is being instituted. NAFTA of today is the same plane as the Niña, La Pinta, La Santa Maria, and La Mayflower. And so what we're speaking of now, what we're presenting to Mr. Nair, is the need to provide an analysis regionally to these human rights violations of indigenous peoples, where the three state sovereignties of the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, and the overarching economic paradigm of the NAFTA regime be addressed as a system of infrastructure that never provided free, prior, or informed consent, the opportunity for us as indigenous people to consent in that economic regime. So as a result, it returns to be another instrument of colonization, to where our lands, territories, and labor are exploited and expropriated for the benefit of these economic enterprises, which turn out to be manifestations of colonization, which is a crime. It's illegal, and it has to be called to account. There has to be accountability for these processes. In September will be the fifth year when the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples finally and for the first time acknowledge that we as indigenous peoples also have that right of self-determination as peoples equal to all other peoples. That did not exist until 4 years ago. So we're in the fight for self-determination. We're fighting genocide. And in terms of the fight against genocide, the first battle must be to recognize that we are part of humanity. And that's what the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples finally does for the first time.
So before we end, can you let people know how to get in touch if they want to find out more information? Where can they go?
Sure. Our organization is Tona Tierra. Our website is www.tonatierra.org. We have a set of blogs where we report on these different developments at the UN Permanent Forum and the educational component that I referenced, the Shinashti, tonatierra.org.
Okay, and that's www.tonatierra.org. Thank you, Tupac.
That's it,
for... Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Saki. It's a pleasure to be with you.
The U.S. Human Rights Network is dedicated to building a people-centered human rights movement in the United States. For more information about the network and how to become a member, visit www.ushrnetwork.org. We also want to hear your feedback. Get in touch with us by emailing info@ushrnetwork.org. Thanks for listening to Dare to Struggle, Dare to Win. Join us next month.